Good evening.
That's
better. Thank you. And welcome to today's meeting, tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. By the way, you can find us online at thecommonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and at Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. And for those of you in the live audience here today, you also have the added benefit of being able to ask questions. So you'll be getting cards, as I think you were told before. Make sure you write. For those of you who will be listening to me later on radio, you don't get to because you were too cheap to come tonight. But if you come to a future meeting, you can do that as well. I'm Joe Tooman, your moderator and provocateur for this program. I'm a professor of political and legal communications at San Francisco State University, but more importantly for this program, I'm the father of two adult children, and I have lived to tell the tale. In fact, I think my son is somewhere in the audience tonight. Where are you, Nate? There he is, sitting in the back, as usual. Okay. We'll talk about him later. As Stanford's beloved freshman dean, Julie spent 10 years guiding incoming freshmen in their transition to college and adulthood. Many of the students were away from home for the first time, and Dean Julie, as her students called her, helped provide the support her students needed to be successful. After 10 years as dean in 2012, Julie left to pursue a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, and in her own words, Julie's new book, How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Kid for Success, is an anti-helicopter parenting manifesto. Many believe parenting today has become about teaching kids what to think rather than how to think, and that kids are being prepared for college before they even enter preschool. That's very true, by the way. Julie argues that when this happens, our children lose the ability to grow into self-thinking adults. I'm sure almost everyone here has gone through the stress of the college application process, either with yourself or with a loved one. Hopefully, this program will give you a new perspective on the experience and a little insight into your child's mind. As a mother of two children herself, that journey has led Julie into this book on both a personal and a professional level. Please help me in welcoming Dean Julie Lithcott-Hames.
Thank you, Joe, for that lovely introduction. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for having me tonight, to my friend Mike Bracco and my friend Leslie Garvin for introducing me to the Commonwealth Club. I also want to give a shout out to the members of the Stanford community who are here. I know the Stanford Alumni Club helped promote the event, so thank you to Stanford. And there are some important, I see lots of friends in the audience, which is awesome. Hi. Hi. I want to acknowledge one of my research team members, Lee Marshall, is here. And if there are any others who are here that I didn't get a chance to see, okay, there were six amazing humans who helped me do the research for this book, and Lee is one of them. Thank you so much, Lee. Also, my mother is in the audience. My husband is in the audience. Yes, that's right. My mother is here, so please clap extra loud. Okay. Good evening. Oh, no. Come on now, San Francisco. Good evening.
Good evening.
Normally at an event like this, we would ask you to put away your cell phones, but if I may humbly say so, I aim to start a movement with my new book, How to Raise an Adult, and if it's not to be televised, then at least it can be socialized. So whip out those phones tonight and use them. If you're on Facebook, please check in at the Commonwealth Club and like How to Raise an Adult. Take a picture of yourself with the book later and post it. And if you're on Twitter, our handle is @RaiseAnAdult, and our hashtag is RaisingAdults. Live tweet this event, if you know what that means, and tweet your takeaways after. And if you're not a social media user, hi, Mom. Okay, yeah, put away your phone and make eye contact with me. That's a precious resource these days, and I'm going to cherish that, too. We're here tonight to discuss my book, How to Raise an Adult, which its publication almost 6 weeks ago has branded me as somewhat of a parenting expert. But to be frank, I'm not so sure how I feel about that. I mean, I didn't set out to be a parenting expert. And for that matter, I'm not particularly interested in parenting. No. And now some of you are wondering, what the heck am I doing here? I thought she was going to talk about parenting, or I got dragged here in the middle of a perfectly good summer evening to hear a talk on parenting. Well, some of you are thinking and wondering, what is it that's going on? But even at the risk of your disappointment and perhaps confusion, I'll say it again. I'm not interested in parenting per se. What I'm interested in is human beings. I believe in humans. I believe in all of us, you, me, you, way in the back. making our way in the world. I believe this not only for the sake of each individual, but for the sake of us all. You see, I believe the world needs us, each one of us, to figure out who we are, what we're good at, what we love, what we value, and then to work very, very hard to be the very best version of that self we can muster. Now, from my work with countless young adults, I've learned that having the courage to be who we are, regardless of what other people want or say, even parents, is the path to a meaningful and rewarding life. And so with that as my interest, I'm also interested in what gets in the way of each of us being our best self, in the obstacles. And I'm interested in doing something about it. I used to think the obstacles stemmed chiefly from otherness, okay, from outsiderness, from being on the margins due to family background, circumstance, demographic, status. And yes, of course, those things are obstacles, sometimes tremendous obstacles, to a person's chances for becoming their best self. When I was freshman dean at Stanford, I presumed that it would be students from those backgrounds who would most need a caring, thoughtful dean, someone to believe in them when perhaps their background and family narrative collided with all that Stanford would ask and expect of them. And yes, some of my most favorite moments as dean were indeed spent mentoring such students. So, since I was expecting that the students who would most need my help would be the quote-unquote other, imagine how surprised I was to discover among my more affluent, well-connected students each year a growing number who seemed to lack the ability to make their way independently in the world, as, frankly, 18 to 22-year-olds used to be able to do, and just as crucially, used to desire to do. And I'm deliberately being a bit vague about what exactly was missing in more and more students each year because, frankly, I couldn't quite tell at first. Something was just odd. Something was off. It took most of my 10 years as dean before I figured out what exactly the problem was. For starters, each year my students were more and more and more and more and more accomplished. They had done so much. You know what I mean? Let's face it. You know what I mean. Not just the grades, but the scores. And not just the grades and the scores, but the awards and the accolades and the activities and community service and leadership and such perfection. Yes, my students each year were seemingly more accomplished than the last. Yet, each year I noticed that more and more could tell you what they'd done, but not so much why they'd done it. They could tell you what they'd achieved, but not so much about what mattered to them. These students were far more interesting to look at on paper than to talk with in person. Was any of this stuff really their passion? Did they even know what that word meant, or was it just something someone, everyone said they needed in order to get into the quote-unquote right college? Did they have a budding sense of self? Had they ever been given the chance to develop that? Or were they just really good at listening to what their parents said was right for them? I believe in humans, and seeing so many promising young adults walking a path of someone else's making perplexed me. Now, as this was going on, year after year brought more and more parents who came with their kid to our college, and not just to our college, this was happening at colleges and universities all over the United States, more and more parents who came with their kid to college and stayed, sometimes, yes, for real, sometimes literally, but more often virtually, to ask questions, select courses, activities, majors, internships, and careers, solve problems, handle conflict, defend and advocate for their student, register for classes, fill out applications, track deadlines, and call to wake their kid up. And to top it all off, that's the right response. There's a woman about seven rows back who's like, "What?" Yes, to top it all off, my students weren't mortified when their parents did all of this. Who would be mortified to have so much help? They were grateful. They communicated with a parent multiple times a day, in the dorm, in the dining halls, in the student union, going to class, going to the next class, going to the class after that, going somewhere after class, in the lobby of the advising office, even in my office. Or they tried to. "It's my mom," they'd say sheepishly with a shrug. "Do you mind if I just get this? I'll just, mom? I believe in humans, so I thought to myself, something is not right. Is this college or middle school?" Mm-hmm. Remember the movie The Stepford Wives? Some of you old enough to remember the movie Stepford Wives, the 1975 feminist allegory of women who were not actually humans, but instead were robots programmed by their husbands to be the paradigmatic perfect wife. Well, that movie came to mind as I watched my students live their college lives, still somehow looking over to the sidelines for mom or dad's direction, protection, or intervention, as if they were 5 years old playing soccer and needing mom or dad to point in which direction to kick the ball. I began to wonder and to worry, are we raising Stepford children? Yes, of course, closeness, affection, love, frequent communication between parents and children, that's all good. Who among us wouldn't wish for a closer relationship with our own parents? I'm a member of Gen X, the latchkey generation. So this kind of constant communication between parent and adult child at first seems so cute to me. But when the dynamic between parent and adult child is this constant chatter about choices, possibilities, and outcomes, the should and shouldn'ts of life, the want to and ought nots, the how do I do this and the let me take care of that for yous, when it came to all manner of their academic, professional, emotional, and personal lives, this intertwinedness moved, in my view, from a cute family picture to a rather disfigured portrait of a chronologically adult man or woman incapable of fending for themselves. You see, my students were not only celebrating the joys of life with parents, they turned to them whenever something went even mildly wrong, a flat tire, a tiff with a roommate, less than great on an assignment, as if their first instinct was to call or text a parent, an instinct as natural as taking a breath of air and as essential. They didn't seem to know how to contend with what life would throw their way, how to sit with discomfort or indecision or opportunity and emerge with their own sense of how to handle it. So intertwined with their parents, they didn't seem to know how to be their own selves, their own beautiful selves. As a believer in humans, that's what made me worry for their future, and even for our future as a species, which, believe me, I know sounds kind of hysterical, but when you work with thousands of the so-called best and brightest, and you see in them a growing number who have a kind of existential impotence, as I call it, and then you talk to colleagues at colleges around the country, and not just at the elite schools, but at schools in every tier, and they're seeing this, and you realize this isn't just a Bay Area thing or a Stanford thing, but a middle and upper middle class American thing, and then you see that the rates of mental health problems in children and adolescents and young adults are soaring, particularly in affluent communities, you get concerned. Really concerned. And that concern for humans is what made me write How to Raise an Adult, a book on, well, as it turns out, parenting. What's going on? I can't tell you how mortified I was to discover the answer staring back at me in the mirror one day. Every fall at freshman orientation, I got to give a talk to parents who were there to drop off their sons and daughters. The purpose of the talk was to embrace parents, empathize with the big transition they were experiencing, and ask them to go home. "Trust your kid is capable," I'd say, i.e., stop doing everything for them. "They're ready to engage this opportunity they've worked so hard to earn," i.e., stop interacting with the university on their behalf. I never actually wagged my finger at Stanford parents, but inside I was thinking, come on, folks, back off. This is college now. Go away. In 2009, the day after giving that annual speech, I came home from work, sat down for dinner with Dan and our two kids, who at the time were 8 and 10. And I reached over and began cutting my 10-year-old son's meat. And it was like all of a sudden, I was being visited by Dickens's Ghost of Christmas Future or something. If you want your kid to be independent at 18, at some point you have to stop cutting their meat. I sat up straight. When do you stop cutting their meat? When do you stop looking both ways for them as they cross the street? When do you stop helping with homework? When do you let them talk to strangers? I realized I was still treating my kids like little kids. They never went anywhere alone. They did no chores. They had no responsibilities. I praised every little thing and tried to ensure that the path in front of them was as smooth as possible. One day earlier, I had been tisk-tisking my students' parents about not letting go of their college-age sons and daughters, only to realize the next day I was fostering tremendous dependence in my own kids with no end to that in sight. Was I in danger of being one of those parents who wouldn't be able to let go when my kids were in college? What? Me? That night, I realized I'd been given the rare gift of seeing the results of thousands of upbringings and childhoods in the form of other people's grown sons and daughters. Why was childhood no longer preparing kids for independent adulthood, I wondered. Why were college students and 20-somethings now referring to themselves as kids? And how would my generation pass the mantle of leadership on to such adults? How am I and countless other parents getting it so wrong? Because it's not as if we aren't trying. God knows we are trying so very hard to get this right. So for some perspective now, let's go back to how it all began. In the beginning, our love is our umbilicus, our heartbeat, our body, and then it's our arms, our kiss, our breast. We bring them home to a sheltering roof, and we delight weeks later when they make their first intentional eye contact with us. We nurture early babbles into first words and applaud as they gain strength to roll over, to sit up, and to crawl. We scan the horizon of the 21st century and see an increasingly interconnected and competitive world that at times seems familiar and at times utterly not. We gaze down at our precious little one with a promise to do all we can to help them make their way into the long life that lies ahead. There's no amount of direction on our part that will make them stand or walk before they're ready. So we watch and wait and clap and encourage. It may be the last time we actually believe in failing, in falling, in failure as the essential teacher, the builder of a human's capabilities and resilience. We see almost immediately that they're their own person, but we also want them to start where we left off, to stand on our strong shoulders and benefit from all we know and can provide. So we expose them to experiences, ideas, people, and places that we think will help them learn and grow and thrive. We want them to reach and be stretched by the kind of rigor and opportunity that will maximize their potential and their chances. And we're sure we know best what it takes to succeed in today's world. And we're quite eager to protect and direct them and be there for them at every turn, whatever it takes. Boy, do we mean well. But in communities like ours, doing whatever it takes has come to mean what I call the checklisted childhood. All the things our kids must experience and achieve in order to gain entry to a small number of schools and a specific set of careers and therefore be successful in life. So in furtherance of that, in the checklisted childhood, everything is safe, selected, chosen, recommended, planned, decided, approved, improved, done, accomplished, handled, coached, figured out, fixed, arranged, solved, resolved, absolved, shaped, designed, orchestrated, and dreamed for them. Then we hover right on. Yes, let's have some applause. We're applauding, I think, because we know it so well, and we know what it feels like, and it sounds so horrible in the aggregate. Then we hover over our kids as they try to check off all the items on the checklist. We keep them safe and sound and fed and watered. And when we see an obstacle in their path, we try to remove it, all the while encouraging them along, nudging, cajoling, hinting, helping, haggling, nagging, as the case may be, to be sure they're not screwing up, not closing doors, not ruining their future. Calling for help when needed in the form of tutors, coaches, handlers, extra spiffy coaches and handlers, in order to improve the child in front of us. We say we just want them to be happy. But when they come home from school, all we ask about is their grades. And they see in our faces that approval, that love, that worth comes from A's. When the work is hard, we stand ever closer, running alongside with clucking praise like a trainer at the Westminster Dog Show, coaxing them to jump ever farther and soar ever higher, arguing and contending with the rulemakers when they fall or fail, forcing them back on the path, using our own strength to boost their effort. Their ears are filled with our chirps of perfect, a rhetorical tick we've come to use, even when we don't mean it. And we commend them to our friends and with stickers on the backs of our cars. And also, we commend ourselves. Look what we've done. We did this amazing science project. We wrote this beautiful essay. We earned this GPA. We got this SAT score. We've gotten into this college. Right? Recognize any of that? I can tell from the nervous titters that you do. I sure do. In communities like ours, and I live in Palo Alto, by the way, in communities like ours, parents have the disposable time and the disposable income to do everything for our kids. And when I finally connected the dots between that dinner with parents of Stanford freshmen and what was happening at dinner in my own house, I realized that this omnipresent over-involvement means kids grow to be chronologically adult while remaining utterly stunted, dependent on parents to do not only the heavy lifting of life, but the lovely, light, ethereal dreaming as well. Look, my book is called How to Raise an Adult, but it could just as easily have been called The Road to Hell. Because our child's perfect path was paved with the very best of intentions. But if you look at what we've done, if you have the guts to really look at it, you see that when we've walked so closely alongside our kids, when we've told them not only what to do with their lives, but how to do it, and when we do the work for them when they struggle, and when they aren't struggling, we just overhelp to ensure that they get the extra edge. When we make them study a certain thing and shape their dreams, tell them who they must be to make us proud, we've actually undermined our kids' chance to make their own way. Too many playwrights and poets are forced into STEM. A teenager commits suicide, and his obituary includes his SAT score. And you know what the worst part of this is, besides how arrogant it is to chart some other human's path, how unethical it is to overhelp with their schoolwork, how cruel it is to be a constant crutch that will not always be there for them, how harmful it is to condition love on performance? The worst part, unintended yet insidious, is the hidden message that worms its way into their developing hearts and minds. Psst. I don't think you can do this without me. Trying to boost them up, paradoxically, we are tearing them down. We overhelp so as not to disadvantage them, yet they're disadvantaged because we do so much. You're not good enough for this life as you are, is the message. You never will be. You need me. You will always need me. I believe in humans, and I have to tell you, we're smothering the life, the very sense of self, out of our kids, our precious kids. Our job as parents is to put ourselves out of a job and raise our precious offspring to independence. We gave them life, but life is to be lived. In order for them to become the beautifully unique individual they are, we have to let them be. We've succeeded as parents if our adult children can fend for themselves. And by the way, fend means look after and provide for oneself without any help from others, not call your parents and have them fend for you. We're supposed to want that for them. But these days, too many of us seem sickly engaged by their need to constantly need us, a need, remember, that we manufactured. We've got to back off for our kids' sake, but also for our own. As you know by now, I believe in humans. And guess what? That includes us parents, too. Many of us, too many of us, spend our lives scheduled to the hilt between work and home, homework and homeroom, practice tests and practice fields, trying to keep up with the judgmental Joneses. Ours is an endless shuffle to a rehearsal, a practice, a tutoring session, an expert of some kind designed to make our kid better at something. We are on autopilot in our minivans, going through the motions, making the snacks, being on the committees, arguing with the teachers, principals, coaches, and referees, serving as our kids' concierge, personal assistant, secretary, fearing our spouse's expectations, vaguely wondering when we'll get off the sidelines of soccer practice and start living our own rich, vibrant life again. Our morning medication is caffeine. Our evening medication is wine. And long, long, long gone are the days of throwing open the back door and saying, get out there and play, I'll call you for dinner. There are no wide open doors anymore, no wide open afternoons for that matter, and no one is home to play with. There's only the schedule and the drop-off and the pickup and some semblance of that family dinner we all know we're supposed to have, and then the homework, until some set of us plus them is exhausted. Sleep, repeat. When I was writing How to Raise an Adult, a mom in Palo Alto pulled me aside at a meeting and pleaded, when did childhood get so stressful? I put my hand on her shoulder, and as tears slowly filled her eyes, another mother who had overheard nodded her head. And then the second mother leaned in and asked me, do you realize how many moms in our community are medicated for anxiety? I didn't know the answer to either question, but a growing number of conversations like this with parents like these became another reason to write my book. I believe in humans, in all of us, and I guess you could say that my role as a college dean afforded me a view of the future that frightened me. And now I'm running back to warn you, all of us, that this overly protective, overly directive, overly hand-holding way of parenting is harmful to kids, to parents, to us all. I'm here with this book and this rhetoric and this book tour and some kind of authority that comes from it all. But did you really need me to say any of this to you? No. You know it. We all know it. We hear about 20-somethings and even 30-somethings failing to launch. We see our children withering under the pressure of the checklisted childhood. We feel ourselves struggling to do all that parents do to ensure that checklist is adhered to. We remember our own freer childhoods lived not that long ago, and we imagine a different, saner way for our own kids and ourselves, perhaps elsewhere, I don't know, Wyoming. Yet, we look over our shoulder and see the galloping herd of other parents who are constantly hovering over their kids, cultivating them like precious little bonsai trees, spending more money, hiring more help, taking more time off just to ensure their kid makes the grade, makes the cut, gets admitted to that school over our kid, bragging about their outcomes. We want to trust our instincts, wish we were brave enough to walk away, focus on family time, not test prep, incite laughter, prompt joy, let our kids just be. But we fear the overparenting herd and the short-term win their kid will achieve with all that help. Even when we know better, the overparenting herd is like a bully we feel the need to go along with, lest we be hurt by them even further. Look, you know, and I know, we love our children with a driving force, an aching, fierce, terror, joy we can barely even understand. It is the most humbling, precious, bewildering task to raise another human. 10 years ago, when I wrote my first piece on the harm of overparenting, I was just a college dean with a lot of compassion for young adults and a mounting concern that something was just not right. 10 years later, there's now abundant evidence in the form of study after study from the field of psychology that our overprotection, overdirection, and excessive handholding harms kids. It deprives them of building life skills, it renders them less than capable in the workplace, and it leads to much higher rates of anxiety and depression. We must do better. Look, there's a lot that's wrong in society. Larger forces that both constrain and impel us as parents. But let's not forget that we have tremendous control at what I call the local level of our kitchen counter and dining room table, where we've got children who'll need breakfast tomorrow. Join me in doing right by those children, by leaving the herd of hoverers, by fostering independence, not dependence, and by supporting them in being who they are, rather than telling them who and what to be. Together, we can push the parenting pendulum back in the other direction, away from overprotected, overdirected, handheld forever children, and toward raising adults. Thank you.
Am I mic'd up? I think I am. Good. Well, for our internet and our radio audience, this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're talking with Julie Lithcutt-Hames, former dean of freshmen at Stanford University and author of the new book, How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, go out and buy one, and prepare your kid for success. I'm Joe Tooman, your moderator. And now it's time for the audience portion, pardon me, the audience question portion of our program tonight. And I'm actually going to start with one as we're starting to get more of these in. If some of you haven't written these up yet, please write your questions and send them up, please. So Julie, start with this sort of question. When I was 7 years old in the mid-1960s, I got a bicycle for Christmas. I remember it was a red Stingray with a banana seat and red stripe down the middle and butterfly handles and these silly tassels, which I promptly removed. And I remember getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning before my parents got up, and I went into a dark living room and tripped over this thing. And my father getting out of bed and finding me, and he was about to yell at me, but then he sort of said, just go back to bed. And I couldn't wait to wake up, and I got up at 6 in the morning before anybody else, and I went waking everybody up, and I said, I have a bicycle. And that was the last they saw of me. And I was gone until dinner time. Now, we lived in Turlock, California, which is kind of flat, so you can't fall off anything. And but I'm sure there were people that abducted children then, and there were cars that could have hit me and the rest of it, but it never really bothered my parents that I was gone. As a father, when my daughter was 7 years old and my son, who's with us today, was 4, we were traveling in France and we were renting a flat in Nice in the south of France, staying in this nice old hotel which had become a condo place for old people, and we had borrowed a room. And my daughter begged me one morning to let her and my son go down the stairs and across the street to this boulangerie, a bread place, basically to get some croissants. And at that point, as our parents, we had never been, unless we had given to other adults, physically separated from our children. And so my wife and I sort of looked at each other, and we had a little conversation, and my daughter was pretty good at manipulating situations, said, you know, we're never going to learn unless you give us a chance. So we just said, trust me, you don't know the half of it. And so we just sort of said, yeah, that's fine. And I remembered riding that bicycle. And they walked out, and they went down these stairs. There are no elevators in this place. And long, you could hear them talking all the way down. And the further away they went, and their voices became more distant, the more this impending sense of doom settled in on me. And I waited at the door, and I kept looking out the window and the rest of it, and I was fighting this impulse to run out and make sure they were okay. But finally, I just gave into it. And I think, Nate, you probably were gone for like 17 minutes, something like that. Wasn't that long. Not that I was keeping time. But eventually, I heard them. I was literally just about to put my hand on the door when I heard the voices coming back up the stairs, whatever it was, 20 minutes later, 17 minutes later. And they appeared, and they had eaten everything they were supposed to bring for us as well. Another lesson I learned. And I found myself as a parent in the moment being grateful that I had fought the urge to stop them, but wondering what had possessed me in that moment to not have suggested that they just go do this anyway. I mean, my parents didn't worry about me, and France is a pretty family-friendly country and the rest of it. In your book, now to my question, you mentioned a bunch of causes of the baby boomer generation, what I'll call when kids started appearing on milk cartons, child abduction. You mention in the book this orientation towards achievement, the creation of play dates, the self-esteem movement, a whole bunch of things. Which of these causes for our generation do you think was primary in causing parents to shift in this way and begin this process of being so possessive or over-parenting, over-nurturing of kids?
Thanks for that question, Joe. Yeah. I'm glad I was taking notes. There was so much good in what you said, and I think the notion that you had to fight that urge as your heart was, you know, beating a hasty exit from your chest. You were so fearful about what might happen, and yet you took some deep breaths and watched them go and let that happen. I mean, that's what all of us do and need to do. And so thank you for kind of sharing what that feels like. We could all picture you in France. So here's, you know, I wanted to know what was going on. I became a college administrator. I was a corporate lawyer for a number of years, and I became a college administrator in 98 and freshman dean in 2002. And in 1998, my colleagues at Stanford were beginning to see parents all of a sudden coming and not leaving. You know, parents used to wave goodbye at the bus station or the airport, you know, or would drive and drop them off and turn around. But now parents were staying. And they weren't just staying, they were wanting to be very literally involved in decision making and transactional things and so on, and arguing over grades and everything, really. And I was wondering, how did this happen? So if you think about who was going to college in 1998, they were about 18 then, so they're born around 1980, the start of the millennial generation. And I learned that the millennials, their little precious young selves, were subjected to stranger danger in their early childhood. They were the first. Self-esteem movement, the play date, and this notion that, you know, we need to be taught to the test and have a lot more homework. And so their lives, their childhood, had in a number of important ways been encroached upon by very well-meaning parents, such that when they became 18-year-olds and were heading off to college, it was quite natural for mom or dad to want to be right there alongside them, because they always had. And in the beginning, in 1998, it was a small group. And a small and odd group, I will say, we giggled when we saw them, and I'm not kidding, because it was unusual. But each year brought more and more parents who seemed to feel they had an important role to play in the life of their college-age son or daughter, and we really had to contend as a university with, okay, how do we treat these parents respectfully while also really helping these young men and women to grow in their own sense of self? You asked what caused it. You know, I'm not sure that there's any one of those four factors that was more prominent than the other. I will say this, there's a great irony here. Who were the parents in 1980? Baby boomers. I know there are many of you in the audience. Love you guys. You're awesome. I'm Gen X, sandwiched between you and your kids. But the baby boom, famously known for advocating for their own self-actualization in their teenage years and young adulthood, changing the paradigm of America in so many ways, were now so fiercely advocating on behalf of their own kids, they seem to be robbing their own kids of the chance to be self-actualized. It's really crazy if you think about it. So I think it was a baby boom mentality that, hey, we've got, you know, we know what's best, and we're gonna be there to ensure what's best happens all the time, in the classroom, in a play date, you know, with regard to our kids' homework. You know, we are quite capable, and we're going to ensure that our capabilities are really right there alongside our kids every moment of existence.
Okay. So it's about boomers. Okay. I'm a boomer, but I think you're probably right. That actually may be the reason, as you said, that my generation said our test scores, we got into this school. It's us. It's not about us, really, but we're making it about us, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's a good answer. Let me join a couple of questions from the audience and take you in a slightly different direction. And one of the people in the audience wrote, shouldn't a parent become actively involved with her child's academic future if her son is an underachiever and has psychological challenges such as depression? And I'm going to join that along with any advice to the parent of a young adult generally, so this isn't necessarily just for college, with mental or social health issues. It's hard not to hover in that situation.
Yeah.
And finally, this question as well, so either for school or not, please comment on children with learning issues. So that's not necessarily a mental or social issue, but it is learning issues. What are your suggestions for their academic success, and what should the role of the parent should be?
Yeah, so, you know, I think I made clear at the outset in my opening remarks that I didn't set out to be a parenting expert. You know, I've written this book. I've done a lot of observing and a lot of reading of research. But what I say at the end of the book is stop looking to experts for the answers. Trust yourself. You know your own kid better than anybody else ever will. And your own kid and their developmental issues and the circumstance in which you're raising them and the community in which you live are all far more important than most things you're going to read in a magazine or a book. Okay, so to those who have kids with special needs, learning disabilities, physical challenges, I say to you, I had to look to your community, broadly speaking, for guidance on how do you teach life skills in kids. Parents of kids with special needs have had to figure out how to teach the very skills that their disability might be hampering or hindering the development of. Okay, so I learned from people in this community, and I, again, very broadly speaking here, referring to the special needs community, that there are 4 stages for developing skills. And it turns out these 4 stages apply whether your kid is developing typically, as it's called, or with special needs. Stage 1, first you do it for them. Whatever the task is, crossing the street, making a simple meal, buying something in a store for the first time, learning how to do math homework. First you do it for them, then you do it with them. Stage 3 is then you watch them do it. And stage 4 is then they do it on their own. And of course, how much time elapses between stage 1 and 2 and then 2 and 3 and 3 and 4 has everything to do with your kid, you, their age, the stage, whatever it is. But keeping in mind this 4-stage approach, it actually applies to almost everything we need to teach them. In furtherance of the very long-term goal that at 18 or 20, or if you want to buy into it, 25 or 29, whenever you decide adulthood should actually happen, okay, I believe if we're sending kids into harm's way at 18 to fight and die for our country, we ought to be sure they all have the life skills and wherewithal to be an adult, okay? Certainly by 21, okay? So keeping the long-term goal in mind that we're meant for them to be independent of us, we want that for them. And guess what? They don't magically acquire those skills at the stroke of midnight on their 18th birthday, and it's cruel if you've left it that long. You know, every single moment of childhood, every day, every week provides a chance for you to say, how can I build more independence in my kid, whomever they are, regardless of their challenges? You know, there's that opportunity for you. If your kid has special needs, if your kid is depressed, if your kid has a situation that is outside the norm, I'm not telling you not to hover. Of course you need to be more involved. Of course you need to be paying closer attention. Okay, absolutely. There are plenty of parents, however, with kids who are developing fairly typically, who are feeling this need to kind of always be there, to always hover, to always be the one asking the question, to make sure the problem is done right. You know, that's the problem. That's the problem. That's what's undercutting their chance, you know, to kind of blossom and thrive into their own life.
Okay, very good answer.
He's grading me, I can tell. I've gotten 2 very good answers.
No,
he is a professor.
You answered the question.
San Francisco State. Okay. It's funny for me to be on this side of that, I have to say. Oh my gosh, I might get a B. What am I going to do? Okay. Don't ask me a hard one. That's a joke. Ask me a hard one.
Reaching for my... No, I'm just kidding. No. I'm going to read a question and I want to piggyback onto it. This is a very interesting question. The commenter wrote, "I agree you have defined a real problem, but not all college students fit this pessimistic picture." So I guess he or she is challenging some of that. Mm-hmm. "Perhaps a growing number, but likely less than 30 to 50%, you choose. What do you see in the backgrounds in those teenagers and young adults who thrive today?" And, well, actually, I'll ask that question, then I'll ask the second one.
Okay. Absolutely. Whomever asked the question, you're absolutely right. I'm not making the case in any way that all young people today are like this or that all parents are like this. What I'm saying is that each year brought more and more parents who were hovering and over-involved and fewer students who had the wherewithal to act like adults. And I decided we got to do something about this because at some point we may reach a dangerous tipping point. I mean, if you think about it, you know, the baby boomers are retiring. Gen X is a tiny generation, but is now in the leadership, you know, level age. We're going to hand over that mantle of leadership to millennials. We got to know they've got it. We're going to need them to look after us one day and raise their own kids. Okay, so my alarm bell is, hold up, folks, something's not right with many. But not all. Okay, so what's the difference? There was such a clear dividing line. The students who'd not been raised with hovering parents, when things went wrong, they would say, oh, wow, that you know, that was too bad, or a worse word, you know, you know, and they'd get over it, and they wouldn't feel the need to text mom or dad, or, you know, they didn't need to mom or dad to soothe them through that, if you will. If they got a grade they didn't like, you know, they felt, well, I either earned that grade, or I really feel I was evaluated. I was evaluated improperly. I'm going to go talk to the professor. You know, and they'd summon the guts to go talk to the professor. They had a roommate dispute. You know, they'd work with the staff in their dorm about the problem, figure out how to talk to the roommate, and figure out how to escalate it to the next level. I mean, as college students always used to do, is the refrain. Okay, so why do we ask less of college students today? You know, the world is more complicated. The economy has been horrendous lately. If anything, we need these kids to be even more fierce, even stronger, even more resilient than many of us ever were. We're not supposed to, but we shouldn't act as if we can always prevent and protect them from life's greatest challenges. We can't. We've actually got to prepare them for them and actually allow them along the way these opportunities to talk to adults on their own behalf and advocate for themselves.
Okay. And we're talking in some of this about students. A different question. This is the part I wanted to piggyback on. Is it possible, we've been talking about parental complicity in this, over parenting. Is it possible that universities, per your example, encouraged a perfection or achievement by adjusting their standards to accommodate this? Or would you argue, as someone who worked for a university, that they were merely reflecting a shifting demographic brought on by baby boomers?
Oh, Joe.
So, meaning, in other words,
I know what you're meaning.
It's not just parents that need to change. Do schools need to reevaluate as well?
Absolutely. Yes, as the lady in row five. You know, I've been talking about this issue for many years, and when I worked for a university, I was blind to the role that colleges and universities played. I said and believed, and still do believe this, that universities aren't telling parents to do their kids' homework. Parents are doing their kids' homework. And I don't care why you think you ought to be doing that. That's just wrong. You know, for so many reasons, including you tell your kid that they really are incapable of being the fourth grader or the eighth grader or the 10th grader that they are. Okay, but now that I've been away from the college and university environment for 3 years, and my research assistant Lee is nodding at me because we really examined this issue, I've come to appreciate that the arms race for college admission has us by a stranglehold. And who's at the lead when it comes to that, fomenting that arms race? Say it with me now, U.S. News and World Report. I don't know how this magazine decided they knew anything.
I thought you were going to say Stanford. Okay, so no. I'm kidding. I went to Cal. We're just as guilty. I'm sorry. So U.S. News and World Report.
I really don't need to say anything because you're answering your own, making your own points. Yeah. I'm just going to take the high road and resist saying anything about Beat Cal. Sorry. It just slips out. And the people listening who aren't from the Bay Area are going, what are they talking about? Okay, so here's the really important thing. U.S. News and World Report makes money off of telling us what the top 20, 30, whatever, however many colleges are. They are the equivalent of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition.
Yeah.
Truly, Gwen Ifill has said this on her show, but truly, it is the, in other words, it's the issue annually that makes oodles of money and keeps the entire franchise afloat. Okay? Well, I would wager that you shouldn't be choosing a college the way someone might choose a swimsuit. Yeah. You know, all right? So here's the point. It is impossibly hard to get into a small number of colleges and universities these days. The admission rate at Stanford, where I attended school and was dean, is now about 5.02%. That's 1 in 20. It's like winning the college admission lottery, okay? Be excited if that's where you want to go. Be excited if you get it. But don't beat yourself up if you don't, because those odds, as I tell young people, were never in your favor, okay? They're not in anyone's favor. They're horrendous. And the schools continue to seek more applicants. You know, this is a national thing, not a Stanford thing. They seek more applicants, drive up their selectivity, and admit fewer people, and leave us frazzled and afraid, and our kids feeling like failures if they don't get into those places. So here's what I'm going to tell you. We must pull back the blinders on our own narrow-mindedness about which colleges and universities matter. Some of the very best teaching in this country takes place at community colleges, at small liberal arts colleges, at state schools, and as well at some of the elite private universities. If we can pull back our blinders and be willing to look at many, 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 many more schools, we'll discover there are amazing opportunities for our kids that have far more merciful acceptance rates and where our kids can find that all-important sense of fit and belonging. There are 2,800 accredited four-year institutions in this nation, and as with anything, I'd wager that the top 5% are worth looking at. Are you with me? That's 140 schools, most of which you haven't heard, okay? So I'm saying to myself, to my husband, to my community, dare to look at lists beyond U.S. News. Look at colleges that changed lives. 40 tiny, tiny colleges, most of which you haven't heard, except for maybe Reed colleges on there, where alumni and faculty and students and trustees say, this place changed my life. Who wouldn't want to go to a place like that? For example, okay, there are plenty of other lists you can look at. Try to get off the elite brand name bandwagon and actually select a college or university based on what they offer, the quality of the teaching. Our faculty teaching students should probably be your number one question. You know, not graduate students, but faculty, okay? The second part of the answer is, Malcolm Gladwell has said, because you might be feeling, okay, fine, she's telling us to look at other schools. Okay, fine. Here's why you ought to. Here's why it's actually good to go to a place. You're shooting for tier one, why don't you go to tier two? You're shooting for tier two, why don't you go to tier three? Malcolm Gladwell's research in David and Goliath says that the people who fare best at college are those who have the chance to be in the top 5 or 10% there, because it's those students on every campus who get access to the professors and the research and the extra goodies opportunities. So it's a way to game the system, if you will, to be the big fish in a small pond. Go where you can be the bigger fish, not where you're going to be in the bottom half of a class at a very, very selective place. So there are all kinds of reasons. I talk about this in the book. But in short, we can have confidence that our kids will be absolutely magnificently fine regardless of where they go, I believe, and I will be proud to send my son or daughter, not necessarily to my alma mater, which they won't have any chance of getting into, but to another wonderful school in this nation, probably a small liberal arts college is you know, what I'm hoping for them.
Okay, very good answer. You know, I promised you in the green room I wouldn't throw you a curve, but you're doing such a great job with free association. I just want to think outside the box a little bit with this. I'm mixing my metaphors. I'm sorry. I don't know if the answer is that you just wouldn't do this, but I'm wondering as I listen to all this how your checklist might change if the population we were talking about were parents in low-income families, maybe single-parent low-income families, in poor inner city areas or in rural areas that offered limited options or resources. Are there, because obviously you're talking about usually parents with means and who have ambition for them, and that's a different population, but are there still some things in what you've said that could really apply for anybody listening to different parents in different circumstances?
Absolutely.
And what would that be?
Yep. So in the book, right up front, I say that this is a problem in communities of affluence where parents have disposable time and money to spend cultivating their kids every moment, okay? And this is a great irony, another great irony, like the baby boom self-actualization irony. The other one is our affluence actually ends up harming our kids because it means we're doing too much for them. They don't develop that kind of grit and resilience that come from working harder to get through life, okay? So this is where, if you're an affluent person, your kids' less privileged peers, kids who are from poor backgrounds, working class backgrounds, maybe they're the first in their family to go to college, if they make it that far, and I'll answer that question next, have a set of skills in their toolkit, as James Wilcox, who runs the Aspire Public Schools, has said, an extra tray in their toolkit that comes from having had a tougher life. They've got what it takes to take public transportation and advocate for themselves and earn money and speak up when they need to. You know, they have a set of skills their more affluent peers lack. This is how the more affluent kids end up looking like veal out in the world. This is a term coined by Joe Maruzcheck in Massachusetts. He's a superintendent. He's been working in Massachusetts for years. He says they're like veal, and they run home in the face of the world's slaughter. We don't want that. Poor and working class kids do not look like veal. If you're listening and you're thinking, I am one of those poorer families, I am working class, you know, what do I need to do to cultivate my kids? I would say education, education, education is the key. It has always been the key in this country to making more of yourself and providing more opportunity for your kids. So I would say wherever you are, find the best school that you have access to in your community and send your kid there and pay attention to the fact that they're doing their work and read books to them. You know, that and a mentor, a really great mentor, can make such a difference in the life of a child. And my mother, who's an educator, I know is sitting in the audience. She probably wants to jump up and,
where is Mom,
and
by
augment
the way?
My answer. There she there is. You are. There she is. So that's my answer. Yes.
Okay. Back to the other parents then. I have two questions that are pretty similar. I'll read them both to you. One person wrote, help me get over this emotional hurdle. If I stop helicoptering, my sons won't be able to compete against all those children with parents who do helicopter. And then something which is sort of similar, how do we help our kids be competitive for college and the world if we have to compete with the overparenting herd who are unfairly giving their kids a leg up?
Yeah. These are the right questions, folks. These are the right questions. So, number one, the emotional hurdle. How is my kid going to compete with those other kids who are being overparented? Here's what I'm going to tell you. This is born of my years as dean, where I worked with about 18,000 young adults and knew a lot of them, right, Lee? I knew a lot of my students, okay? Those who have the wherewithal, those who have the sense of self, those who know they've done their own homework, those are the ones that really make it through college with a spring in their step and a strong stride. Think about it. If you've always helped with the essay, if you've always helped with the math homework, if you've always been there to fill out the forms, argue with the teachers, they know they haven't done it themselves. Then they get to college wherever it is, and they will still need your help. And if there was a psychological expert in the room, that person would stand up right now and say, and that's what undermines their self-efficacy. We're talking about fundamental aspects that make up a human being. So what I'm saying is, those other kids might have a short-term win. They get on the team. They get on the better team. They get into the better class. I don't care. At some point, it will catch up with them. And those manufactured kids who've been overhelped will be bewildered young adults, unable to do for themselves because mom or dad has always done for them. It's bleak. You don't want that. To the second question about college specifically.
Yeah.
What I know is this, and this is to your question about what the colleges and universities are doing. They're not trying to get kids to mortgage their childhoods. I know so many deans of admission and college admission officers. They are so distraught over what this has become. You know, it's the kind of thing where if you're gaining weight over months, you don't realize it. But if you look at a picture of yourself from, you know, 2 years ago and then you see it, right, you see the incremental change. Okay, college admission, when I applied to Stanford in 1984, what it took for me to look great on my application was nothing compared to what it takes, you know, to get a kid to look great in the eyes of a college admission officer today. But kids are still only 17 today, just like I was. And there's only 168 hours in the week today, just like 1984. Why are we asking our kids to have done more and more and more and more and more? It's wrong. It's harmful. And the admissions folks are waking up to this in part because they're in dialogue with the mental health professionals on their campus. And they're beginning to connect the dots and see, wait a minute, we're asking them to mortgage their childhood. In the book I say, this is a debt that can never be repaid. You don't go back and get your childhood back, okay? This is a debt that can never be repaid. And so admissions officers are starting to say, I know, because they, you know, I hear them talking about it and they talk to me. What can we do to send a different message? Well, you can ask, you can make a statement. You know, we don't want you to mortgage your childhood. We don't want you to be handled through this process. Who you are on your own is what we want to see. Okay? And maybe set up a question where there's an ethics thing where you check a box and say, I was not handled through this process. This is my own work. You know? Or another suggestion from Larry Momo, who's at the very elite Trinity School in New York City, has stood up at the college board and said, you know what? Decide for every college, decide which grades and scores you want an applicant to have in order to demonstrate they've got the intellectual chops to succeed on your campus. Whatever campus you are, you decide where the cutoff is. You know, you decide what GPA from high school and what SAT or ACT score. Let those kids through round one. But guess what? There are thousands, tens of thousands. Fine. Now you're looking at the subset. Take the grades and scores off the table, so you're not actually pretending that a 3.914 is markedly different than a 3.812 or a 3.797. You know, I mean, we're asking kids, we act as if those differences mean something, and they mean nothing when it comes to who will this kid be in the classroom, who will this kid be in the dorm, what will they be like in the research lab or on the playing field. Find out they're intellectually capable and then focus on some of the more subjective things like their letters of recommendation and their essays. And when it comes to writing essays, I tell every kid who will listen, just write about something that actually matters to you. You don't need some package coach handler person to write the perfect essay for you. The colleges actually want to get a glimpse of you. No matter how obscure, wacky, weird your interest is, to be honest, the wackier, weirder, the better, because you'll stand out. You know, no matter what you're interested in, it could be bugs, it could be 18th century French literature, it could be anything. Dare to tell them who you actually are. That's the best advice I could give anybody in the college admission process. Your grades and scores are a way of conforming with expectations. Your essay is the opportunity to say how you're a unique individual, and they're trying to admit unique individuals.
Okay. Good answer. By the way, once again, this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're talking with Julie Lithcott-Hames, former dean of freshmen at Stanford University and author of her new book, How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Once again, I'm Joe Tooman, your moderator. This next question, I think we have 5 minutes left, so we'll try and maybe make the answers a little shorter so I can squeeze in one more question. But I thought this was funny. I was waiting for it to come out. Somebody asked, would you or have you done a debate with a tiger mom?
I would love that.
And...
Bring it on.
Wait.
If she's listening, wait. If Amy Chua is listening, I would like her to know that I would love the opportunity to talk about these topics with her, because I have seen kids of tiger parents behind closed doors in my advising office, and I have seen them fall apart.
Okay, well, I'm guessing we were getting the answer to the next question. What's your opinion of the tiger mom's parenting techniques, and why does Stanford accept kids without independent will? Okay, not pulling any punches.
What was that? Why does Stanford?
They wrote it. I didn't say it. Okay.
Without what? An independent. Oh, that's just
really
the
true, though.
Berkeley
and
you coming out. Okay. You know, if this was November, I would be leaping across the stage and pummeling you.
That's okay.
Okay, that's when we play big game. For those of you who don't know. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I tend not to use the phrase helicopter parent or snowplow parent or tiger mom or this and that. I've broken it down into three types. Overprotecting, you heard me say it. Overprotecting, overdirecting, that's the sort of narrow vision of success and the harsh approach to you must do these things in order to be successful. That's the tiger type. And then handholding or being their concierge, okay? So the tiger parent is the overdirecting type. And there is such arrogance in the notion that, you know, any of us knows best what another human being should do with their life. Of course, we parents are older, usually more educated. We've got life experience. We've got connections. Okay, we know a lot. But there's a difference between forcing your kid to major in this, pursue that career, and providing opportunities and information and exposing them to different things, okay? You want to do the latter, not the former, okay? You do not want, I'm not kidding. I have sat, and by the way, tiger parents come in every ethnicity, okay? Amy Chua makes out that this is a Chinese-American parenting approach, and there are plenty of Chinese-American parents who don't parent this way. As well, there are those who do. As well, there are plenty in ethnicities beyond Chinese-American who parent this way. I've seen it. You know, I've seen the white parents from New England parenting this way, and the Midwest, and so on, okay? I've sat with their kids. I've sat with their really accomplished kids who have great GPAs and have accolades, and they're brittle, and they're fragile, and they're terribly, terribly sad. And you know, who wants to feel sorry for a Stanford student who has a 4.0? Boo-hoo. Well, when you see a human in front of you who hasn't had the chance to dream for themselves, chart their own path, it's a very sad thing, actually. You know, it's a very sad thing. There's a guy in my book who's profiled, African-American, tiger mom, Stanford, Harvard, lawyer, okay? Lawyer, he's a lawyer in Los Angeles because his parents made him. From age 12, he said, they sat me down and said, grad school isn't an option. You will go to grad school and it will be law school and we know best. And bum, 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 bum. And he was very good at following their very narrow lead. And he got to a point in law school where his mother was still calling him many times a day. When he said to me, he said to her, Mom, your voice is the only voice in my head. I need to hear my own voice. And he threw that phone across the room, and he didn't talk to his mom for 6 months, and he went into intensive therapy. In his mid-20s, someone who walking down the street, you would say, wow, he's a highly accomplished person. Whatever it says on his resume, I can tell you, he was withering as a human inside, and once he summoned the guts to say, back off, Mom, I'm here to live my own life, that is when life started to become sweet for him.
Well done. All right. I know we're at time, but I'm going to run out one last question so we don't end on that because it was very sad. but good, I think. In the way of some advice, this question I asked you before, I think most of us as parents would say that one of the hardest parts of parenting, over-parenting, whatever it is, parenting, is letting your child fail. And so my question to you, maybe for all of us as your closing remark, is what's the best way in your experience as Dean or as a parent to balance knowing when to intervene and when not and just to let them fail?
So I think we've got to keep in mind what I said some moments ago, that our job as parents is to put ourselves out of a job and they're supposed to be independent one day. So how do we put opportunities for independence in their way? Okay, independence comes with trying and failing. And we think the stakes are so high in the fourth grade, but let me tell you, they're much higher in the eighth grade. And let me tell you, they're much higher in the 12th grade, and they're much higher in college and the world of work. So what you want to do is not be increasing your help along the way and getting to that point of, oh my gosh, they're in college now. Well, of course I have to do their work for college because I've done it in high school. How could I let go now? Nuh-uh. It's the opposite, right? You want to be pulling back. Every moment of childhood is an opportunity to push them forward. So I'd say you have to get comfortable wincing, but not pouncing. There's a wonderful book called GIST by a couple of guys in Minnesota, Minneapolis, a pediatrician and a child psychologist got together to write this book. And their book is about this. It's about some of the really tough things you actually want your kid to experience so they toughen up, so they gain some wherewithal to be in the world. You know, it's the disappointments of life. It's the small bumps to their ego. It's the small bruises on their body. You know, it's the things none of us want our kids to have happen. But when they happen, instead of reaching in, rushing in, trying to prevent, trying to, you know, we've just got to nod and say, yep, that was hard for them, but it's exactly what they needed to have happen because that's how humans learn. Because that's how humans learn. We're not neglecting them. We're teaching them. Life's greatest teacher is failure. We know that in Silicon Valley, right? Failure way forward is the mantra. It's true.
It's true.
You gotta fail. If you're not taking risks, you won't fail. You know, you gotta try and fail and try and fail and try and fail and then succeed. We all know that from our own lives. It's time we parent that way as well. That's cool.
Our special thanks to Julie Lithgow-Hames, former Dean of Freshmen at Stanford University. Are you getting tired of me saying that? And author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Children, Kids, pardon me, for Success. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. And now I'm Joe Tooman, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.
Yay.